Mountains would spring up from the plains and would travel and climb on the shoulders of other mountains, causing faults and drifts. Lakes would be tilted and emptied, rivers would change their beds, large land areas with all their inhabitants would slip under the sea. Forests would burn, and the hurricanes and wild seas would wrest them from the ground on which they grew and pile them, branch and root, in huge heaps. Seas would turn into deserts, their waters rolling away. And if a change in the velocity of the directional rotation slowing it down, should accompany the shifting of the axis, the water confined to the equatorial oceans by centrifugal force would retreat to the poles, and high tides and hurricanes would rush from pole to pole, carrying reindeer and seals to the tropics and desert hons into the Arctic, moving from the equator up to the mountain ridges of the Himalayas and down the African jungles, and crumbled rocks torn from splintering mountains would be scattered over large distances, and herds of animals would be washed from the plains of Siberia. The shifting of the axis would also change the climate of every place, leaving corals in Newfoundland and elephants in Alaska, fig trees in northern Greenland and luxuriant forests in Antarctica. In the event of a rapid shift of the axis, many species and genera of animals on land and in the sea would be destroyed, and civilizations, if any, would be reduced to ruins. Water evaporated from the oceans would rise in clouds and fall again in torrential rains and snowfalls. Clouds of dust, ejected by numerous volcanoes and swept by hurricanes from the ground, and possibly dust clouds of extraneous origin, if a comet train of meteorites was the foreign body causing the upheaval, all this dust would keep the rays of the sun from penetrating to the earth. The temperature under the clouds would be reduced, but close to the ground it would be higher than normal because the heated earth would, by convection, dissipate its heat into the atmosphere. Great streams would be formed by the melting ice of the polar regions, carried out of the polar circle, and heated by the ground. Glaciers from the mountains would dissolve and inundate the valleys. In higher and in temperate latitudes the falling snow would turn to water or even vapor before reaching the ground or soon thereafter. For many months and probably years, the snow falling on the ground would melt and run in great streams to the sea, cutting new river channels and carrying off great masses of debris. Falling again and again in a sunless world, the snow, shielded from the sun's rays by thick clouds enveloping the earth, would finally cool the ground to the point where it would turn, not into water, but into ice. At first this ice would not lie firmly on the ground. From slopes it would slide down to the deeper valleys and then toward the sea. Large icebergs would fill the sea and, tossing about, melt and drop a load of stones or other detrital material to the bottom. Other icebergs, floating over valleys filled with water, would deposit their loads there. In the course of the years the incessant action of the snow would cool the ground in the higher latitudes to such an extent that a permanent cover would be built. And the earth would go on shuddering for centuries, slowly quieting down, and as time passed one after another the volcanoes would burn themselves out. This catastrophic shifting of the axis, once or a number of times, is presented here only as a working hypothesis but, without exception, all its potential effects have actually taken place. Assuming now that the working hypothesis is wrong, we are faced with the necessity of finding a special explanation for each and every phenomenon observed. The mountains rose from the beds of the seas and folded and faulted. What generates the enormous forces that bend, break, and mash the rocks in mountain zones? Why have sea floors of remote periods become the lofty highlands of today? These questions still await satisfactory answers. Climate changed, and the continental ice cover formed. At present the cause of excessive ice making on the lands remains a baffling mystery, a major question for the future reader of Earth's riddles. Species and genera of animals were extinguished. The biologist is in despair as he surveys the extinction of so many species and genera in the closing Pleistocene, the Ice Age. Equally sudden and unexplained changes accompanied the close of each geological period. What caused tropical forests to grow in polar regions? What caused volcanic activity on a great scale in the past and lava flows on land and in the ocean beds? What caused earthquakes to be so numerous and violent in the past? Puzzlement, despair, and frustration are the only answers to each and every one of these phenomena. The theories of uniformity and devolution maintain that the geological record bears witness that from time immemorial, even from the time this planet began its existence, only minutes changes, caused by the wind blowing on the rocks, the sand grains swimming to the sea, accumulated into vast changes. These causes, however, are inadequate to explain the great revolutions in nature, and they evoke expressions of futility on the part of the specialists, each in his field. Ice and tide. Having shown that only global catastrophes could have brought about the building and spreading of ice covers, I shall now go on to demonstrate that many effects attributed to ice were caused not by it but by onrushing water. The simplicity with which cosmic catastrophes can explain the origin of the continental ice covers should not make us uncritical. The same catastrophes caused great tides to rush over continents. Both phenomena, waves of translation and ice covers, took place. Tidal waves traversed continents, moving by inertia when the daily rotation of the Earth was disturbed. The ocean water also retreated from the equatorial to the polar regions, returning to the equator with the adjustment of the diurnal rotation. These tidal waves, augmented by others produced by the extraneous fields of force, and by tides generated by submarine earthquakes and hurricanes, were the main agents that dispersed erratic boulders, distributed marine sediment over the land, covered the ground with drift. Invasions of the land by the sea, torrential rains, prodigious snowfalls, floods caused by the melting ice cover, and multitudinous icebergs sliding into the sea, all contributed to the readjustment of the mantle of the earth, shifting the sea, floor sand, the disintegrating rock, the lava, the volcanic and meteoric dust and ashes. The Arctic lands were denuded and their detachable mantle was washed away. Thus was formed the barren stone surface of the Canadian Shield, its soil being earned away as drift. The erosion and drift, the excavation of lakes and valleys, and their filling in with clay, boulders, and sand have been ascribed to ice that eroded and moved the debris along. The opponents of the Ice Age theory, the last of which is George McCready Price, pointed to the effect of the ice cover in Antarctica on the rocks beneath. Ice plays there a protective and not an eroding role. It shields the underlying rock from the erosive action of the elements and especially of the high-velocity winds that blow most of the year in this part of the world. Yet in rapid motion, with many stone fragments and other debris under it, ice could scratch the bedrock and erode and flute the slopes of valleys. But it is doubtful that the weight of the ice would excavate lake basins in cold, hard rock. The ground was heated, lava gushed out of the earth, formations were softened, and oceans, pouring water and stones on rock and lava, made deep impressions in them. When, after the mountainous ice cover was formed, the ground in a new paroxysm gushed lava under the ice, the latter steamed and, subsiding, pressed with a great weight on the softened ground. In this manner, too, ice could excavate beds of lakes and leave other deep marks on the ground it once covered. Before the Ice Age theory was conceived, drift and erratic boulders were ascribed to the action of great tidal waves. But with the advent of this theory, the role of water in the deposition of drift and erratic boulders was denied. Gigantic waves, wrote J. Geikie, were supposed to have precipitated upon the land, and then swept madly on over mountain and valley alike, carrying along with them a mighty burden of rocks and stones and rubbish. One this view assumed, however, the former existence of a cause which there was little in nature to warrant. A late opponent of the Ice Age theory, Sir Henry H. Haworth, 1842-1923, sought the origin of such tidal waves in a sudden rise of a mountain chain or in an earthquake of the oceanic bottom. As we have learned o preceding pages, a disturbance in the axial rotation of the earth must have created a displacement of the oceans and their eruption on land, and this very cause, the disturbance in the axial rotation of the earth, must have acted also in order to build the continental ice covers. It also changed the profile of the earth's crust, lifting some mountains and leveling others. All this created scenes of the utmost complexity. An example is the old but not antiquated description of the northeastern United States from Maine to Michigan and New Jersey by J.D. Whitney, professor of geology at Harvard, 1875-96. In his work, The Climatic Changes of Later Geological Times, 1882, he wrote about this area as a region where the glacial phenomena exhibit the highest degree of complexity. We are beset with difficulties when we attempt to solve the problem presented by the northern drift in northeastern America. Extreme complexity in the direction of the striation, proof of the former presence of the sea over a part of the region, and of fresh water over another extensive portion, enormous accumulations of detrital material evidently deposited by water, occasional peculiar transportation of boulders in a manner not in harmony with anything we see ice doing at the present time, occurrence of linear accumulations of sand gravel, and boulders closely resembling the Ossar, Scandinavian crests of drift, in character, proofs in some parts of the drift region of the prevalence during the glacial epoch of a colder climate, and in others of one warmer than that now existing. These are some of the difficulties which must be met by those who undertake to solve the problem of the northern drift of northeastern America. The theories of warm interglacial periods and of the deformation of land and its submersion as the result of the removal of the ice cover could explain the puzzling phenomena in some cases, but in many others they could not do so. Thus bones of seal and walrus are found in Holderness, Yorkshire, with fresh water mollusks of warm climate. Despite its anomalous elements, the deposit is classed as interglacial. In similar strata in Yorkshire, hippopotami are found, too. The glaciers in the Alps served as observational material for deductions concerning the continental ice cover. However, alpine glaciers carry stones downhill, not uphill, and the general question was asked whether ice could carry rocks uphill. Erratic boulders are often found in places where continental ice could hardly have deposited them. Charles Darwin inquired and learned that erratics are found on the Azores, islands separated from the ice cover by a wide expanse of ocean. Cumming described erratics close to the summit of the Isle of Man amidst the Irish Sea, where only waves could have lifted them. 8 in Labrador boulders have been seen, rammed against the slopes of the hills, which could have been done only by a tidal wave. As already said, in India, in an earlier ice age, detritus and blocks were carried, not from the land toward the sea, but in the opposite direction, from the sea up the Himalayas, and not from higher latitudes toward lower, but in the opposite direction. The whales in the hills of Mont and Quebec were cast there by an erupting ocean. The very profusion of erratic boulders in many places of the world, some dunes covering wide stretches of a country, whether carried by ice or by tides, presents the problem of their origin. They must have been broken off the mountains in great numbers at a time when ice and water were thrown into action. The mountains must have been under stress, the massifs must have been heated and split, or shattered by earthquakes, they must have been mashed and twisted and rent when the sea stress pushed their borders and carried their billows to mountainous ridges, red and bursting. Magnetic poles reversed, when rock is liquefied it is non-magnetic but, cooling to about 580 degrees centigrade, Curie point, it acquires a magnetic state and orientation dependent upon the magnetic field of the Earth. After solidifying, lava rock retains its magnetic property, and it would retain it even though it became displaced or the magnetic orientation of the Earth changed. In all parts of the globe rock formations are found with reversed polarization ; 1 paleomagnetism almost every month detects more areas of inverted orientation. Sufficient experiments have now been made to allow only one plausible explanation of this invert magnetization, that the Earth's magnetic field was itself reversed at the period when the rocks were formed. At the same time it was admitted that no known mechanical or electromagnetic local effect can cause a reversal of magnetization over such an area. An even more puzzling fact is that the rocks with inverted polarity are much more strongly magnetized than can be accounted for by the Earth's magnetic field. Lava or igneous rock, on cooling below the Curie point, acquires a magnetic charge stronger than the charge this rock would acquire in the same magnetic field at outdoor temperature, but only doubly so. The rocks with inverted polarity, however, are magnetically charged 10 times and often up to 100 times stronger than they could have been by terrestrial magnetism. This is one of the most astonishing problems of paleomagnetism, and is not yet fully explained, although the facts are well attested. Thus we are confronted with an ever-growing puzzle. The cause of the reversal of the magnetic field in the rocks of the Earth is unknown, and the fact contradicts every cosmological theory. The strength of magnetization of the rocks with inverted polarity is astonishing. Now, if the Earth's axis changed its direction or position under the influence of an external magnetic field, we should expect to find the following. The external magnetic field would create eddy, electrical, currents in the surface layers of the Earth. The currents would create a magnetic field around the Earth that would counteract the external magnetic field. The strength of the magnetic field created by the eddy currents would be dependent on the external magnetic field and the velocity with which the Earth traveled through it. The thermal effect of the electrical currents would liquefy the rocks. The process would be accompanied by volcanic activity and intrusion of igneous rock into surface sedimentary rocks. The molten rock would acquire a magnetic state as soon as its temperature dropped to about 580 C. Also, those rocks that were heated below this temperature would acquire the orientation of the prevailing magnetic field. It is also apparent that an external magnetic field that could shift the terrestrial axis in a short time would have to be of considerable intensity. We have all three expected effects: lava flowed and igneous rock intruded in the form of dikes or otherwise. The heated rocks acquired a reversed magnetic orientation. The intensity of their magnetization is stronger than the Earth's own field could possibly produce. In the section A Working Hypothesis, it was asserted that the formation of the ice cover, pluvial phenomena, and mountain building could be explained if the Earth's axis was shifted, and it was assumed that the axis was shifted by an extraneous magnetic field. Now, the circumstance that rocks the world over show reversed magnetic orientation and an intensity of magnetization which the Earth's magnetic field could not have induced, proves that our assumption was not unfounded. In a recent article, S. K. Runcorn of the University of Cambridge reports that the evidence accumulates that the Earth did reverse its field many times. The north and south geomagnetic poles reversed places several times, the field would suddenly break up and reform with opposite polarity. The source of the terrestrial magnetism is supposed to be in electrical currents on the surface of the terrestrial core. Substantial changes in the speed of Earth's rotation become easier to explain. Whatever the mechanism of the origin of the terrestrial magnetic field, there seems no doubt that the Earth's field is tied up in some way with the rotation of the planet. And this leads to a remarkable finding about the Earth's rotation itself. The unavoidable conclusion, according to Runcorn, is that the Earth's axis of rotation has changed also. In other words, the planet has rolled about, changing the location of its geographical poles. He charted the various positions of the North Geographical Pole. The next question, then, is, when was the terrestrial magnetic field reversed for the last time? Most interesting is the discovery that the last time the reversal of the magnetic field took place was in the 8th century before the present era, or 27 centuries ago. The position of the ancient vases during firing is known. They were fired in a standing position, as the flow of the glaze testifies. The magnetic inclination or the magnetic dip of the iron particles in the fired clay indicates which was the nearest magnetic pole, the south or the north. In 1896, Giuseppe Folgoreto began his careful studies of Attic, Greek, and Etruscan vases of various centuries, starting with the 8th century before the present era. His conclusion was that in the 8th century the Earth's magnetic field was inverted in Italy and Greece. Italy and Greece were closer to the south than to the north magnetic pole. P. L. Merkanton of Geneva, studying the pots of the Hallstatt age from Bavaria, about the year 1000, and from the Bronze Age caves in the neighborhood of Lake Neuchâtel, came to the conclusion that about the 10th century before the present era, the direction of the magnetic field differed only a little from its direction today, and yet his material was of an earlier date than the Greek and Etruscan vases examined by Folgerator. But checking on the method and the results of Folgerator, Merkinton found them perfect. An ancient vase found by F. A. Forel in Bundemoges, on Lake Geneva, was broken and its pieces were scattered and lay in all directions. When assembled, they all showed one and the same magnetic orientation, which proves again that the magnetic field of the earth was unable to change the orientation originally acquired by the clay when fired and cooled. These researches, continued and described in a series of papers by Professor Merkinton, presently with the Service Meteorologique Universitaire in Lausanne, show that the magnetic field of the earth, not very different from what it is today, was disturbed sometime during or immediately following the 8th century, to the extent of complete reversal. The 8th and the beginning of the 7th centuries before the present era were periods of great cosmic upheavals, described in Worlds in Collision, pages 207, 359. At one of the occurrences, the solar motion appeared to be reversed, reflecting some disturbance in the terrestrial motion. Volcanoes, earthquakes, comets. A great chain of volcanoes girdles the Pacific Ocean. The Andes in South America are studded with many volcanic summits, among them the loftiest volcanic mountains in the world. Cotopaxi in Ecuador is over 19,000 feet high. The Andes reached their present height only in the age of modern man. Magma intruded into the rock and lifted it. In many places magma reached the surface, broke through vents, and built craters. Most of those volcanoes, however, are already extinct. Manley speaks of the possibility of its, Earth's magnetic field, reversal in historical times, 2,500 years ago, to be cleared up by more research. However, the more exact date is, according to the original works of Folgerator and Merkinton, the 8th century before the present era, or shortly thereafter. Central America abounds in volcanoes, most of them extinct or dormant. The highest, Orizaba in Mexico, over 18,000 feet high, was active for the last time 3 centuries ago. In the United States, few volcanoes are active, though many became extinct very recently, in the geological sense. Alaska, the Aleutian Islands, the Kamchatka Peninsula, and the Kurile Islands encircle the northern Pacific with a volcanic arc. The Japanese islands contain volcanoes by the score, most of them are extinct, some only recently so. Formosa, the Philippines, the so-called volcano islands, one of which is Iwo Jima, the Moluccas, northern New Zealand, the Sunda Archipelago, all are crowded with volcanoes, most of them only recently extinct. In the center of this chain are the Hawaiian Islands, with 15 great mountainous volcanoes, all extinct or dormant except Mauna Loa and Kilauea, two of the largest volcanoes on Earth. How was that 30,000-foot cone built from the floor of the deep sea? One, when, in 1855, Mauna Loa erupted. The lava ran over the land at a velocity of 40 miles an hour, faster than a swift horse. In 1883, when the volcanic island of Krakatoa in the Sunda Strait blew off, it sent a column of pumice and ashes over 17 miles high. It raised tides 100 feet high that carried steamships miles inland and were felt on the eastern coast of Africa and the western coast of the Americas as far as Alaska. It created a noise that was heard in Ceylon, in the Philippines, and even in Japan over 3,000 miles away. This would compare with an explosion in London heard in New York, when Bandai erupted in Japan in 1888. It cast up almost 3 billion tons of material and blew off one of its 4 peaks. But these delayed actions of single volcanoes look like child's play when compared with the forces that in past ages thrust up the Andes, spread the Deccan Trap. The great lava flows, several thousand feet thick, that cover 250,000 square miles in India, built the lava dikes that cross South Africa, spread the Columbia Plateau in America, and laid the lava bed of the Pacific. The Indian Ocean from Java, an island full of volcanoes, extinct, dormant, and active, to Kilimanjaro, an extinct volcano over 19,000 feet high in East Africa, is circled with volcanoes and its bottom is of lava, with several volcanic isles in the middle of it. Along the Arabian coast of the Red Sea stretches a long chain of volcanoes. The numerous craters are all extinct, but it is not so long ago that they became inactive, the last eruptions having taken place in the year 1222 in northern Syria and in 1253 at Aden. In the Mediterranean region Thra, Santorin, which exploded with unusual force about 1500 BC is still active or dormant, Etna on Sicily, a snow-capped volcano, Stromboli, and Vulcano are active. On the mainland of Europe, however, the only active volcano left is Vesuvius. In the past France and the British Isles saw extensive volcanic activity, and though this activity is ascribed to the Tertiary, some of the cones, craters, and lava streams in France stand out so fresh that they might almost be supposed to have been erupted on Ia a few generations ago, in the words of Sir Archibald Geikie. Iceland in the North Atlantic has 107 volcanoes on it and thousands of craters, large and small. None of the volcanoes is geologically ancient, but many of them are extinct. The island is covered with coagulated lava, fissures, and crater formations. Iceland is one of the rare places where in modern times lava streams have been vomited from fissures in the earth without a crater having been formed. From Iceland down the Atlantic, the Azores, the Canary Islands, the Cape Verde Islands, Ascension, and St. Helena are volcanic islands, some of them thrust up from the bottom of the ocean. Their volcanic activity, like the activity of the many known volcanoes on the bottom of the Atlantic, has ceased. In Patagonia, volcanic eruptions have occurred down to fairly recent times, and the land between the Atlantic and the Andes is covered in many places with lava flows. All in all, only about 400 or 500 volcanoes on Earth are considered active or dormant, against a multiplicity of extinct cones. Yet only 500 or 600 years ago many of the presently inactive volcanoes were still active. This points to very great activity at a time only a few thousand years ago. At the rate of extinction witnessed by modern man, the greater part of the still active volcanoes will become inactive in a matter of several centuries. The cause of volcanic activity is supposed to be in movements and fractures of the outer crust of the Earth, however these may be brought about, a matter as yet by no means settled. The coincidence in time and place of mountain folding and volcano building is regarded as significant for the solution of the problem of the origin of volcanoes. Seas of lava and crater formations cover the entire face of the Moon. No one who has observed the Moon, even through a relatively small telescope, can forget this picture of tremendous catastrophe, a flood of molten lava that has engulfed and obliterated craters and mountain ridges in its path. Whether the crater formations on the Moon, some of which reach 150 miles in diameter, resulted from bombardment by enormous meteorites, or are extinct volcanoes, or, as are assumed in Worlds in Collision, are the congealed effects of bubbling activity on the surface of the Moon that became molten. The face of the Moon is indisputable proof of catastrophic events on a planetary scale. The theory of uniformity can be taught only on moonless nights. As with the volcanic activity, the seismic shocks, judged by their effects, must have been of a very different order of magnitude in the past. The earthquakes of the present day, writes Edouard Suess in his The Face of the Earth, Das Antlitz der Erde, are certainly but faint reminiscences of those telluric movements to which the structure of almost every mountain range bears witness. Numerous examples of great mountain chains suggest by their structure episodal disturbances of such indescribable and overpowering violence, that the imagination refuses to follow the understanding. Suess thought that mountain building came to an end before the advent of man, but today we know that it lasted well into recent time, and consequently man must have witnessed the great earthquakes that made the globe shudder. When the Andes rose in South America, according to the description by R.T. Chamberlain, hundreds, if not thousands, of cubic miles of the body of the Earth almost instantaneously heaved upward, produced a violent earthquake which spread throughout the entire globe. Many world-shaking earthquakes must have been by products of the rise of the Sierras, Again, we now know that the Sierras attained their present height in the Age of Man, in recent time. And if we give credence to the records of earthquakes in the chronicles of the ancient East and in those of the classical age, we shall be amazed at the number of seismic shocks and tremors.